morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is James Schneider. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, and if I can, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case arises from the merger of two large corporations conducting business in Omaha, Nebraska, Aspen and Markel Corporation. Aspen, a Nebraska corporation, hired the defendant, Wilkie Farr. Wilkie Farr is a large international law firm that has its principal place of business in New York City. Aspen hired Wilkie Farr in 2009 in order to effect the merger between Aspen and Markel. Wilkie Farr provided legal advice, negotiated the agreements, and drafted the contracts. This case, however, stems from the plaintiffs, who are holders of contingent value rights, who would come to be known as CVR holders, seeking to recover the attorney file that Wilkie Farr generated for that representation. Wilkie Farr drafted and negotiated the agreements and contracts for that merger that ended up being the merger agreement and the CVR agreement, which are discussed at length in the briefing. The CVR holders, who are former owners of Aspen and Markel, eventually got into a dispute about the interpretation of each of those contracts. And in the process of this case, the plaintiffs have brought suit here in Nebraska seeking to compel Wilkie Farr to turn over or at least get a declaratory judgment as to the ownership of that attorney file.
Why do the plaintiffs have a right to that attorney file?
Well, Judge, I think that's a very good question, and it kind of goes to the standing argument that is discussed.
Well, doesn't it also go to jurisdiction and who's in Nebraska and what roles do they play in Nebraska?
Right.
So does it go to both?
Yes, I think it does. Okay. And our response to that is, if you take a look, I think what the district court really did here is discuss the timing of minimum contacts and who those minimum contacts were with. Those contacts came from Wilkie Farr, a New York corporation, to a Nebraska corporation to effectuate a large merger, pursuant to the agreements that were drafted by the defendant.
Let's go through those agreements. There's a initial agreement between Wilkie and Aspen.
Correct. There's an engagement letter agreement between Wilkie Farr and Aspen.
Who's Wilkie Farr representing at that point?
I think at that point, Your Honor, Wilkie Farr is representing Aspen. So then Wilkie Farr on behalf
of Aspen. So that agreement doesn't get you where
correct.
You need to be.
Correct.
So the next agreement is the merger agreement or the CVR agreement?
The merger agreement and the CVR agreement are part of, they're both the merger documents. Okay. They're both drafted by Wilkie Farr. And what you're getting at is that the merger agreement merges Aspen and Markel subject to the terms of the CVR agreement, pursuant to the terms of the CVR agreement. And our position is that the CVR agreement actually operates as a contractual reservation of rights. Now, if you take a look at the Appley's brief, they cite to Great Hill, they cite to Delaware law. If you read the Great Hill case, you will see that the Delaware court finds, yes, all assets of the merging corporation are merged into the surviving entity. However, that can be subject to a reservation of rights on behalf of the surviving entity. And so our position is that the CVR agreement actually does that. It reserves the rights, specifically the rights to the attorney file. And the reason we think it reserves the right to the attorney file goes to the district court's other ruling about when these contacts happened. The district court seems to kind of put a bifurcation between 2009 and 10 contacts, the hiring of Wilkie Farr by Aspen, and the 2016 and 17 contacts when the successor CVR holders reached out to Wilkie Farr to try and get the file. I think that's a false dichotomy. And the reason I think that is that if you look at the evidence that was before the district court, specifically, I'm thinking of 11.2 of the notice provision of the CVR agreement, that provides that duplicate notice actually has to go to Wilkie Farr.
What's the purpose of that?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And if you look at the evidence before the court, when the district court made a decision, I'm specifically thinking of Exhibits 3 and 4, the affidavit of two of the CVR holders, Tom and Luke Uranzian. Both of them say the purpose for that notice provision, that duplicate notice provision, was in order, it was because it was anticipated that Wilkie Farr would continue continue providing legal advice.
To who?
To the CVR holders.
Did they ever provide legal service to the CVR holders?
There's not evidence of that in the record, but what is in the record, and I would point you to specifically paragraph 22, of Exhibit 4, which is the affidavit of Luke Uranzian, one of the Uranzians, That particular individual was actually the president and CEO of Aspen. And when Markel and the CVR holders began to have their dispute, he reached out to Wilkie Farr, and he spoke to an attorney with Wilkie Farr and said, hey, we're having this dispute. It would be really helpful if we could have this attorney file to lend some insight into the interpretation of this particular contract. And the attorney from Wilkie Farr said, we are still your attorneys. We will provide that file shortly. That was in, I believe, June of 2016.
And still now, whose attorney?
Still the CVR holder's attorney, yes, Your Honor.
So is that enough then to
Well, I think what that question, is that enough, goes to what we think is really the heart of this, and that is the plaintiff's motion for preliminary discovery before the district court. We think that's evidence of a continuing and ongoing relationship. And we also think that that continuing and ongoing relationship is evidence that the CVR agreement reserved those rights. And so we said to the district court, look, we think there's personal jurisdiction here, but we'd like to go in and find more evidence of it. And the district court denied us that opportunity. Now, I think if you look at this court's ruling, specifically I'm thinking of the ruling in Williams v. Gould that states any party to an action in which a special appearance has been filed is entitled to discovery to ascertain facts relevant to the court's jurisdiction over the person of a defendant.
What's the standard review in regard to discovery?
Well, I think that's a very, well, in regard to the motion for preliminary discovery, I don't have that in front of me. But what I think the standard of review on a motion to dismiss is actually a really important question to this, because the standard of review is de novo for legal reasons. But on a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction, findings of facts are actually upheld unless clearly incorrect.
What do you think discovery would help you find?
Well, I think very simply discovery would give us more evidence as to whether the CVR holders are truly being still represented by Wilkie Farr.
Wouldn't your clients know that? Wouldn't that be knowledge in their possession?
Yes, and that's why they submitted affidavits to the district court, Exhibits 3 and 4, that say we thought we were still represented by Wilkie Farr, and we don't understand why we're not represented by Wilkie Farr, and we're still entitled to the attorney file from them. But to get back to the question of standard of review, I actually think that's a very good question, because if the standard of review on appeal for findings of fact on a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction is upheld unless clearly incorrect, that's an argument for preliminary discovery. Because now district courts are making rulings on motions to dismiss that may not have a good evidentiary record, that have no discovery, that may be solely on affidavits or contracts, and they're making findings of fact. And we should allow people, we should allow parties who are subject to a special appearance to do some preliminary discovery in order to get more information, in order to get more evidence that there is, in fact, personal jurisdiction.
Again, to Justice Papik's question, what evidence do you anticipate finding that would show a legal representation of the CVR agreement?
Right. Well, Your Honor, I don't know exactly what we would find, but I would point you to two things. I would point out that an attorney from Wilkie Farr did submit an affidavit in this case and doesn't talk at all about Wilkie Farr, thought it was going to, whether the relationship between Wilkie Farr and the CVR holders was or currently is.
I mean, if Wilkie Farr is representing your clients, wouldn't your clients have to know about that? Wouldn't that?
Well, I think that gets back to the difference between 2009 and 2010 and 2016. When the CVR merger agreements were drafted, they included provisions that didn't vest for 6, 7, 8 years. If you look at Section 3.2, I believe, of the CVR agreement, it talks about that the parties have to continue doing things up until May 2018. So when the parties drafted this stuff, they didn't anticipate anything coming up regarding them. But if it did, then they were anticipating that Wilkie Farr would be the attorney that represented them in that case.
Is there currently a lawsuit between the CVR holders and Markel?
Yes, there are.
Where is that lawsuit?
That is in the Federal District of Delaware. And if you look at, I think it's in the first couple pages of our opening brief, we give you the case file and the number.
Why would these materials not be sought in discovery in that case?
Well, Your Honor, they actually have been sought in discovery in that case. But the issue is that while a motion was pending before the Federal District Court to compel a subpoena to Wilkie Farr for those, subject to Markel's objection, the court actually decided to stay the case pending a limited arbitration into the value of the CDRs.
So is this declaratory judgment action a runaround?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think our position being that the CVR agreement giving us actual rights to pursue, we have a right to that attorney file. And part of the reason it's not a runaround, if you look in the complaint, I'm not sure it's mentioned in our brief, but if you look early in the complaint, it's clear that we're not actually seeking privileged material. We're only seeking material from Wilkie Farr acting as Aspen's attorneys to Markell's counsel during the negotiation, so we can have an idea of the interpretation.
How would you respond to an argument that this is not the proper subject of a declaratory judgment action because you have another adequate remedy?
I think the remedy that's pending before the District Court of Delaware, that's about discovery, that's about a subpoena and compelling production of documents. This case is about the ownership of the actual file. Who owns that file? And that's a declaratory judgment.
But as you framed it in the Nebraska court, the purpose for which you're seeking it is to use it in the dispute with Markell.
I think we're seeking to get it, one, because we feel we're entitled to it, and two, because it would lead to some better understanding of what actually happened.
For the purposes of the dispute with Markell.
For any purpose, Your Honor. For any purpose. And with that, I see my time has expired. Thank you very much, and we would urge this court to reverse the lower court.
Thank you very much. Mr. Davidson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Steve Davidson. I'm here on behalf of Wilkie Farr and Gallagher, LLP. And I want to start up with a fact that is in no dispute on this record. This law firm never represented the shareholders of Aspen Holdings. It was retained by the corporation and the corporation only. Its engagement letter specifically said, we are not representing shareholders or other affiliates of the corporation. The topic of that representation was this merger, and when the merger was completed and the corporate documents filed with the Secretary of State of Delaware, Aspen Holdings, the only client Wilkie Farr ever had, ceased to exist. Gone.
So why is there a notice provision saying any issues on the CVR agreement, notice should be provided as well to Wilkie Farr? What's the purpose of that?
Well, remember the notice provision first says if there's an event that needs to happen under this agreement, notice goes to a person who was a shareholder and the representative of the CVR recipient group. And then it said, with a copy that does not constitute notice to Wilkie Farr. It's convenience. It's like somebody's mail for
why does Wilkie Farr care if they're no longer representing any of the parties in the action? If it's done and over with,
it is.
Why does it matter that they get notice of some pending problem?
I think it's a matter of accomplishing information to a person. And what really matters is, does that make them the shareholders' lawyers or not? Of course not. There's nothing in the agreement that creates any duty to act. For example, in response to a notice, they're not authorized to do anything on behalf of shareholders in response to simply getting that notice and saying, here, we got this. I suppose they could be retained at that point if you could get around the conflict issues and all that. But they weren't. And to say that that thin of a thread is enough to create a right for a non-client of the law firm to come to Nebraska, where Wilkie Farr has no presence, and sue them for a file 6 years later, after there's been absolutely no activity involving the shareholders or this law firm, who, by the way, are represented by other counsel suing Markell Insurance in a pending case where this is where all this should be happening. And you asked if it's an end around. Absolutely, it is. They couldn't get what they wanted from the judge in Delaware, so they came to Nebraska, sued Wilkie Farr, where Markell couldn't be involved. And the judge in Delaware, who's managing that litigation, couldn't participate in dealing with whether this type of discovery was necessary or appropriate, relevant, you know, all the measures you would look at. It's the process here is being used as a way to circumvent the discovery process in that other case. And part of the reason we know that is because they came to Nebraska to do it. And they came to Nebraska 6 years after this law firm did anything on this transaction for a different client.
How much of these details regarding the case pending in district court, federal district court in Delaware, is in our record in this case?
The complaint identifies the case, describes it as being in existence and being litigation over whether the CBR holders are owed money under the CBR agreement from Markel Corporation. So we know it exists in the record. We know the subject matter of the litigation in the record. And we know that the reason that the plaintiffs here want the file is to assist them in pursuing those claims against the insurance company. And, you know, think about the position that this request puts this law firm in. You know, this law firm now has competing demands for a file from someone who was never its client, and the opposing party in a transaction in which it represented a client that no longer exists.
Has it, in fact, turned over the file to Markel?
Markel has the file, yes. Because they own it, you know. Delaware law is clear about that.
According to the Delaware regulation,
I don't see where you can even generate an issue on that fact. The statute, the corporate statute in Delaware, is as broad as you can write a statute. Everything that was owned by the merged corporation is owned after the transaction by the successor. And the Great Hill case that's talked about in the brief specifically addresses the lawyer file for the corporation that went out of existence. It's exactly on point. There's just no way around that issue on the merits. And so when Wilkie receives this demand, looks at Delaware law, has Markel Corporation sitting out there saying, you know, we're at least inferentially having, you know, the threat of problems if the file is given over, when Markel is actively litigating that issue in its own case with the same plaintiffs. As I said, really, it puts the law firm in a tough spot. And so what the law firm did was look at the law and say, this is a Delaware transaction. The legal entities and the contracts are all consistently pointing to Delaware law as what controls. And Delaware law has no ambiguity in it whatsoever. It says this file belongs to the surviving corporation. That's Markel. And so the answer was, we can't give it to you. And really, the point is, all of that activity I just described happened in 2016 and later, and was triggered by a distinct event, which was the plaintiff's call and then a letter saying, give us the file. None of that really has any direct relationship with the work that Wilkie did on the underlying transaction, the merger documents. Now, if the corporation or its successors had a claim against Wilkie for something that happened back in 2010 on the transaction, these jurisdictional issues look a lot different.
So if Markel wants to sue Wilkie Farr for malpractice,
right,
barring statute of limitations, things of that nature, Nebraska may be an appropriate jurisdiction to do.
Well, you're talking about two different parties, and I'm not sure what Markel's contacts are.
Well, I thought you just said they got all the rights and privileges of Aspen.
In theory, if they inherited
all that,
sure,
they would inherit that malpractice claim. So
you
they could bring
and if they inherited the citizenship aspects of it, I don't know the answer to that. It's not really an issue here.
Weren't they also principally placed in Nebraska? Didn't they do business in Nebraska as well?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. What I do know is that in this later circumstance involving this file, the defendant now, Wilkie Farr, has no relationship to Nebraska, certainly not enough to support any sort of general personal jurisdiction. And to gain specific personal jurisdiction over it would mean that the contacts that they're relying on are related to the claim that they're bringing and not tangential or on a different subject matter, which is what these really are. And within a reasonable time, that the contacts occurred within a reasonable time of when this claim is being made, these contacts are remote in time, 6 years before at least, with no intervening activity, representing a different client on a different subject matter. And that's how the district court came to the right answer. It said it's just, you know, especially with the color of this other case, you know, around what was being requested, it just simply makes no sense to circumvent Markel and its rights to this file through this distinct action in a completely remote location involving, you know, people who never were this law firm's client and who have no right to the file. The court got it right. There is no personal jurisdiction over Markel here. And even if there were, the plaintiffs have no valid legal claim that would survive a motion to dismiss to have any right to the file under the theories alleged. We ask that you affirm.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on then to the last case of the day, which is Bonas versus Armitage.